Thank you, Francis, for that lovely introduction. Is the mic working good? Great. And I'm honored to be here in this lovely spot. And I thank the museum and the Terra Foundation for including me and for organizing this lovely event. I realize that the following famous sentences from the socialist revolutionary Auguste Blanqui's 1872 book, Eternity by the Stars, are not the first that come to mind when we debate the import of Monet's painting in series. Just putting up the beautiful, lovely display of haystacks in Chicago for you to look at while I read. Such is our point of departure, then, Blanqui wrote, I quote, as we profess the limitation of matter's differentiated combinations and consequently their inadequacy to disseminate celestial bodies throughout the field of the expanses. Despite their multitude, these combinations are restricted to certain terms, and that being the case, they must be repeated to reach the infinite. Nature draws up each of its works in billions of copies and proofs. In the structure of the astral bodies, similarity and repetition are the rule, dissimilarity and variety are the exception. What I write at this moment in the dungeons of the Fort du Taureau, I will have written for eternity on a table with a pen in my clothes, in circumstances that are completely alike. And so it is for each, end quote. These are Blanqui's famous lines. By the time I am done, I hope to have convinced you that these words should be spoken in one breath with Monet's serial pictures, that in fact Monet's seriality reached out into the world of disillusioned radical politics of late Blanqui in ways more unexpected than art history has allowed. When Monet wrote repeatedly to Alice Horchdé from the Belle Île in 1886 that he knew well, I quote, that truly to paint the sea one has to see her every day at every hour and from the same spot in order to know her life just at that spot. And so I redo the same motif up to 4 to 6 times even, end quote, repetition to him had attained as many social as it had aesthetic implications. Monet's turn to painting in series, from the Gare Saint-Lazare paintings in the 1870s to the motifs he painted in Etretat, southern France, the Belle Île and the Creuse Valley in the 1880s, to the infamous first separate serial display at Durand-Ruel of the Grainstack series in 1891, as, of course, has often been heralded as a crucial turning point in the history of modernist formalism, especially its turn to systematization and the series as a coherent and self-sufficient practice, set of objects and events. My claim today, in contrast, will be that this 20th century lineage of Monet's late enterprise, as so much of modernism in general, perhaps, has managed to obscure some of the more particular references to history and especially socialist politics that seriality still implied when Monet began to practice it in the 1880s. I'm not asking again, that is, whether Monet's series have political content, whether they are metaphorically or allegorically political. Of course they are. The Grandes Décorations are unthinkable without their framing as appeasement to World War I. Le Bloc, here they are, already mentioned. Le Bloc, the famous Creuse painting that Monet gave to Clemenceau, was surely a reference to the latter's belief that the French Revolution needed to be seen as one, the terror included, what he called Le Bloc of the Revolution, as Philip Nord indeed has reminded us in his book, The Republican Moment. This, what I want to call soft political Republican tone of Impressionism, is of course well known. What we have yet to explore are the historical and political connotation that seriality itself held in the late 19th century, the philosophical pressures that repetition and recurrence put not only on pictorial representation and the status of the modern work of art, but also on Impressionism's very own conceptions of history and on the possibility of change in the social, within the social, more broadly. That is what I propose to pursue today, to think the politics of seriality itself, by looking especially at Monet's visit to the Belle Ile in 1886. We might want to go from there to think later on about why American Impressionists were not just less political in their pictures, perhaps, as the symposium organizers have asked us to reflect upon, but also less serially oriented than the French painters, and whether these two phenomena are in fact connected, although my Americanist colleagues may perhaps object to that formulation, and I'm happy to be challenged on that front. To be more precise, this talk considers the mutual implications between the theory of the eternal return of history and the emergence of seriality in painting. When, in the 1870s and 1880s, Auguste Blanqui, Friedrich Nietzsche, and others, including Walter Benjamin and Jorge Luis Borges in the early 20th century, established eternal return or eternal recurrence, the belief that the universe has been recurring and will continue to recur in a self-similar form an infinite number of times across infinite time and space, as a counter-narrative to the bourgeois conception of historic progress, they conceived of the universe as inherently repeatable and serial. Recall Nietzsche's famous words from The Gay Science, quote, "What if some day or night a demon were to steal after you into your loneliest loneliness and say to you, 'This life, as you now live it and have lived it, you will have to live once more and innumerable times more.' Would you not throw yourself down and gnash your teeth and curse the demon who spoke thus? Or have you once experienced a tremendous moment when you would have answered him? 'You are a god, and never have I heard anything more divine.'" End quote. Or take Blanqui's case itself, who made the argument that because of the universe's limited number of 64 simple bodies, hydrogen, oxygen, and so on, the infinite must by necessity had to be populated with an infinite set of repetitions and copies after so-called prototypes, the ur-form from which the repetition could keep occurring. Thus, everything at every moment in history necessarily repeats itself and coexists in a multitude of versions, so that prototype and copy also trade priority and shift perpetually. Here's Blanqui. "Repetition becomes indispensable," he argued, and wrote in 1872. Indeed, these kinds of serial worlds, twin worlds, as he imagined them, merge past and present, going back and forth in time, since everything always happens simultaneously. Tomorrow is another today somewhere else. Number one is another number two somewhere else. Since there's no progress, there's no origin, no first account of the world. Nietzsche and Benjamin especially understood the radical potential of the proposition, the liberation of mankind from any fantasy of afterlife, from backworlds like heaven and hell, towards the general attribution of actuality to the entire range of the potential, that the infinite, that is material throughout, as we know our world to be. Nietzsche furthermore called this condition amor fati, the love of fate, and I quote, "that one wants to have nothing different, not forward, not backward, not in all eternity," end quote. So the idea is in Blanquière, because we have a limited number of elements, and the infinite is in its infinity and necessarily of limited options in combination of those 64 elements. Everything has to be, everywhere in the infinite has to be an infinite set of repeated worlds. As Monet began to repeat himself and stayed in one spot in order to relive previous acts of painting or hang the same subjects together in one room, making it difficult to order them chronologically, he began, I think, to embody Nietzsche's and Blanqui's conceptions precisely in the existential ways they demanded, ways of which his paintings then became the serialized record. For one, like a painted series, the theory of the eternal return views time not as linear, but as cyclical. Such conceptions of existence and representation as perpetual repetition, I believe, form one of the conceptual grounds of Monet's first forays into seriality in the late 1880s and early 1890s. Indeed, art history has heretofore overlooked the concrete circumstances that link these two practices quite intimately together. Some facts first, perhaps. When Monet visited Belle-Île-en-Mer in fall 1886, he was there from September 12 to November 25, 1886. He met there the writer and journalist Gustave Geffroy, who we've already heard about, who would of course go on to write some of the earliest, most important criticism of Monet. And that encounter, as I've said, has been influential for the careers of both figures. But art history often neglects to mention that Geffroy was visiting the Breton Island at that time in order to write his biography of Blanqui, the first large-scale biography written of the revolutionary socialist after his death in 1881. L'Enfermé was published in 1887 and in another larger edition in 1897. And thanks to Ségolène's new work on Monet's library, this edition of the book is indeed in among Monet's books. And this book made L'Éternité par les Astres of 1872, Blanqui's theoretical manifesto about the eternal return, which I've already cited, central to his late disillusion with the revolutionary enterprise. Blanqui, in turn, had been incarcerated on the island during the early Second Empire between 1850 and 1857, when he and his mother planned his infamous escape through the very rocks at Port Gulfar that we see in some of Monet's paintings. The citadel in Le Palais, on the other side of the coast on the island, had been turned into a prison in 1848 for political prisoners. It is said that Blanqui's late interest in astronomy began precisely on the island, and Geoffroy recounts all these details in his biography, and Blanqui's investigations eventually led to the publication of Eternity by the Stars shortly after the Commune. Belle-Île and Blanqui could not have been more intimately connected then in the general imagination, and I believe this constitutes at least one of the reasons Monet chose to paint there, or at least perhaps stay longer than planned. By the mid-1880s, Monet had started to select more remote, ever less civilized locales, and had expressed desire to paint in Brittany since the summer of 1886. He would leave finally for Le Palais on September 12 and headed soon thereafter to the wild coast open to the Atlantic that attracted him most. There he discovered the town of Kervouan and the points directly at the sea, Port Gulfar, Port Coton, and Port d'Aumois. The experience there, and I think this is crucial for the politics of the trip, was one of the first times in which Monet deliberately downclassed rather than upclassed himself. The accounts are quite funny. He had to sleep in a pretty shabby annex, more like a stable of a very small, unpretentious inn, and there were apparently mice above him and below him, and he was sleeping next to a pig and eating very simple local food that the innkeeper prepared for him, who would in turn go back to Le Palais and buy fruits and other things she didn't have in order to bring them back for her famous guest. So here's the painter coming to terms, I think, in an early moment with his newly acquired status and wealth, this in opposition to renting dresses for Camille in the 1860s and so on, and imagining for her and for himself an upward mobility. He moved into this inn on September 15th and made the first painting that very first day. By September 18, 4 canvases were in progress. He made 38 paintings altogether by the time he left on November 25th, and only after delaying his departure several times. Here are 4 of the 6 versions he painted of the Needle Rocks. Paul Tucker, Monet series expert, if ever there was one, made the Belle Ile paintings already the true initial foray into seriality before Durand-Ruel's exhibits, claiming that on the Belle Ile, Monet first limited his number of motifs deliberately, painting, as I've said, 38 paintings in total, but only of a handful of sites and vantage points, like the 6 paintings of the Needle Rocks, for instance. A form of concentration and immobility of position and viewpoint still new to Monet's oeuvre at this time, relatively new. Moreover, the paintings were produced in a very concentrated period of time of that visit, and most of them are standard size of 65 by 80 centimeters. So this group of pictures also, if you will, is the first where the formats get standardized. Unlike the Gare Saint-Lazare pictures, for instance, or previously repeated subjects in which formats and point of view vary more widely than they do when he visits here. Monet was willing, moreover, Tucker points out, both in 1887 and in 1889, to exhibit the Belle Ile paintings together as large groups than he did with any other previous body of work. And all of the above, Tucker takes as evidence for the fact that Belle Ile is the moment when Monet's work took a subtle turn towards seriality that would precisely pave the way for the grain stacks and water lilies like no other set of circumstances before. Let me add that it is also in the many letters written to Alice those months that Monet first came to articulate the need for repeat representation. Quote him here again, "And so I redo the same motifs up to 4 and 6 times, even," he says, right? So the number is still a little staggering to him by saying even. And this is really a formulation still rather novel in his written conceptualization of his practice before the mid-1880s. This new concentration on the possibilities of repetition, it has been said, allowed Monet therefore to be more exacting in the natural phenomena that he represented rather than the sight itself, but this new willingness to repeat himself had other conceptual consequences as well, closer to Blanqui's and Nietzsche's terms of internal recurrence. For one, the paintings he created there are quite unique within his oeuvre up to that date. Darker in color, demanded by the dark rocks and dark green water, and more dramatic in their moods, as has often been pointed out, focusing on the harsh elements as he had never before. Georges Petit was, of course, rather unhappy with this choice, trying to get Monet back south, reminding him that he wanted him to remain the painter of the sun, he said. But Monet seems to have wanted precisely the darker, moodier effects, chronicling a more callous world than he was used to, offering him, as he put it, lugubrious effects, he says, or it is sinister, diabolical, but superb, or the sea offers you these tones of glaucous green and absolutely terrible aspects, but I repeat myself, end quote, he wrote to Alice. He painted, he said, working in the same place at all weathers. The famous stories of how Monet braved the elements at the shore, fastening things to his body and the ground, binding canvases to easels, painting while it rained and stormed and while the fog moved in, speak to the struggle with nature, very much sought out in advance, enacted, and for new representational concerns over the ethics of the painter's engagement with sight. Geoffroy, who was among the first to write about the Belle Isle canvases, saw this new, more embattled spirit in the paintings immediately and made it their very program, the new special tone Monet was after. Indeed, he made Monet's fight with the elements out in the same language as the socialists' political commitments. Quote from Geoffroy, the squalls sometimes rip the palette and brushes from his hands. No matter, the painter holds on and goes off to work as into battle, end quote. Geoffroy saw in Monet's paintings above all a set of metaphors for violent struggle, battle, even revolution, old orders, fighting against new ones. About the paintings of the so-called Roche-Guibelle in Port-Goulphare, Geoffroy saw, I quote, in the middle of the port, a rock riddled with holes curved into an arch, a narrow space filled with sea spray and the violent anger of the water, end quote. Perhaps when looking at a canvas like Rocks at Port-Goulphare, the very site of Blanqui's planned but unsuccessful escape, as I've said, or his storm at Belle-Île, we looked at just a second ago as well, he said the following. But the waves that appear, that unfurl from the tops of the frames are adversaries who are worthy of these immobile combatants, the rocks. They rush up in serried ranks, and one is stupefied by the infinity of their number. They fill up the space with the large leaps. They break like blades against the inflexible walls. They dissolve into streams, end quote. In part, Monet's canvases precisely invited such reading. Geoffroy did not simply impose it on them. Monet has hardly ever found more expressive and varied brushwork, as in the storm paintings, perhaps, applying paint in various directions, thickness, curves, and straight, almost as if the variety of forms of water would nearly exhaust the variety of forms he might find for it. Or look at the stunning Port-Goulphare canvas itself, and especially the area where water and rock meet at center and have met for centuries. In red, fiery, and fierce strokes that seem hardly to want to catch the natural color, reddish blades against inflexible walls, indeed, perhaps, Monet has turned to a kind of linear zigzag, almost a hatching approach, which we would be hard pressed to find elsewhere in his work. I'm talking especially about those red scratch marks there in the middle of the rock. These are pictorial signs meant to embody the water's upward battle with the rock in shapes and in color, more allegory of battle and blood than moss and light. Alfred de Lastelot called Monet's Belle Isle paintings as well more violent and excessive than ever before in his application of paint, end quote. If you need perhaps more proof of my propositions, please recall the famous portrait Monet made on Belle-Île of the fisherman he had hired as his porter, known as Poli. It's the picture here on the left. The portrait has in and of itself somewhat of a socialist enterprise, elevating the lowly worker to the level of bourgeois portrayal, and the same site Monet had himself occupied when he made this rare self-portrait up there just before leaving for Belle-Île. We know that Poli was introduced to Monet through Geoffroy, but we have never asked why Geoffroy met Poli in the first place. The reason may be that Poli had been interviewed by Geoffroy for his Blanqui book because Poli was no other than a porter and helper to Blanqui some 30 years before, and perhaps even involved in Blanqui's plans for escape. And Geoffroy wrote this to his mother on October 8, 1886, and there he said to her, "But me, what interests me most is that I went straight away by chance to that part of the island where the memory of Blanqui was still alive. Blanqui's mother lived in the inn that I'm at. The house where Blanqui had been left by a sailor named Doré is two steps away. The port where he wanted to sail out from and the Pogulfar are over the fields from here. The owner of our house saw Blanqui being returned to prison the next morning in a charrette. There is an old fisherman named Poli who often spoke with Blanqui then and who brought him things when he was in prison." End quote. Poli was thus Monet's direct entry into the histories I've been sketching. And on the bottom is a beautiful painting. We have also several drawings by John Russell, the Australian painter, who was also on the Belle Ile in this month and painted Poli as well and employed him. Several versions of his Belle Ile paintings were exhibited in 1887, six at the Six International Exhibition at Georges Petit in spring 1887, and again in 1889, when 12 were displayed in the large retrospective with Rodin again at Petit's. Monet began painting the first grain stack paintings around this time in the summer of 1888, which is of course the first series exhibited by itself in 1891. But we always take that date to be so crucial, right? But the actual pictures were started several years earlier, much closer to the Belle Ile excursion. But even before this date of publicly orchestrated similarity, repetition had become crucial to Monet's practice. When Geoffroy said that if Monet were forced to stay in one place, this is a quotation, in front of one motif for the rest of his life, he would not waste a moment. He would find a different aspect to paint every minute of every hour of every day, end quote. He only echoed Monet's own words from Belle Ile in 1886 that his new pictures were, quote, no more than repetitions of the same motifs, end quote. And now, to conclude, listen once more to Blanqui. "And as for this profusion of additions, there's no reason to worry about the infinite. As insatiable as one might very well be, it possesses more than enough to satisfy all needs and dreams. Besides, this rainfall of proofs isn't a downpour over only one town. It's sprinkled and scattered across fields that are impossible to measure. And it really matters so little whether or not our twins are our neighbors. It's even quite flattering for one to turn up way out there, very far away, farther than Devil Vauvert, and be wearing one's slippers while reading the newspaper or taking part in the Battle of Valmy than it is to be surrendering right now in thousands of French republics." End quote. Monet's series, I suggest, are full of the same hopes, resignations, and realizations about repetition. I'm not suggesting that Monet identified directly with Blanqui's late disillusioned revolutionary socialism, but that he found in the narrative of the eternal return perhaps a conceptual frame for his own shifting pictorial practice and his turn toward seriality. It's the fact that painting its series could mean all of the above, could stand in both for the actual constantly repeated and the infinite potentially filled that the trip to Belle Ile perhaps helped shape above all else. Repetition for Monet as for Blanqui implied both the resignation from revolutionary ideals by making them take place elsewhere, in the next world or on the next canvas, and the potential for a world always already multiple and fully actualized, containing all its truth within its multiplications, exhausting itself in multiplication. As Monet confronted Blanqui, returning to the same spot and making pictures recur, he entertained one of the ways to actualize history itself in painting and not just embed metaphors for history in it. In Benjamin's Arcades project, we find the following note, and I'm reading it to you with this famous funny caricature from the 1870s of painters returning with their various daily effects from a day painted en plein air. The notion of the eternal return appeared at a time when the bourgeoisie no longer dared to count on the impending development of the system of production which they had set going. The thought of Zarathustra and of eternal recurrence belongs together with the embroidered motto on pillows, "Only a quarter hour," Benjamin said. It therefore also belongs together with Impressionism, I think, that style famously called by Jules Laforgue in 1883, painting in 15 minutes. Thank you.